Well, it's good to be here. Last Sunday, there were some comments, especially about my confession. I said, I need to make a confession. I've never told anybody in my whole life this. Well, you can imagine what people just sat up on their chairs. Those that were asleep woke up. And I just told them that I didn't really like to come to church to worship. Well, that did startle them. And I explained that that's not where I do my worship. And I said, the reason for that is for 55 years, I've had the responsibility of feeding the people who come to the assembly, and the responsibility of it for me was such a heavy load that I came to feed others, and I didn't get the feeding myself, and that's just the way it was. Well, after the service, two of the elders came up and said, we understand what you mean when you say the burden of the responsibility of feeding these sheep. And so that was one comment. Another comment was a brother came and said, when I said my time of worshiping the Lord, maybe 2 o'clock in the morning when I wake up and just sit there, lie there and talk with Him, and then I get up early in the morning and read and meditate, that's when I worship. But anyway, then another brother came up and said, I think the Lord was the same way. I think His working with His disciples was a drain on Him. And He took time out to get away from them to go meditate and be with His Father. Does that make sense? I think it. You know, they'd catch Him over there praying. Sometimes He'd pray all night long. Well, and that made me feel. He said, I want you to be encouraged that you're not some weirdo. But then another lady, by the way, came up and said, or she called, and she said, I think you need to rephrase something that you had as the qualities of a transformed life. She said, I smell like Christ. She said, I think you ought to have, instead of I smell like Christ, I smell of Christ. Well, I thought it was a good observation, and it let me know that she was taking seriously what was being said, even if the distinction between of and like is not all that much. But there is a difference. I smell of Christ, because we're not there yet. We don't smell like Him, but we smell of Him. You see the difference? Anyway, those were some observations that came, and I want to just share that with you this morning as we get started. This is a class on the aroma of Christ. And last Sunday's lesson primarily had to do with, are you the same on the inside as you are on the outside? The essence of it was, are you people of integrity? Are we people of integrity? And we asked this startling question, I did, if you were to be turned inside out, would anybody recognize you? And, of course, that brought a silence quicker and people were kind of gasping, and I do too, because none of us is exactly the same outside as we are on the inside. Guess which one is the better picture of us, the inside or the outside, usually? Which looks better? The outside, because there are inside things about us that we don't want anybody to know. Now, today, the text this morning is going to be actually the whole third chapter of 2 Corinthians. We're not going to read it all. We won't develop it all. But that's the scope of this text this morning. Now, in this text, Paul alludes to the context of divine power. He alludes to that. I want you to turn, if you will, me into the text. Turn to 2 Corinthians, the third chapter. And watch as Paul, he alludes to something that's all the way through this 2 Corinthian letter. That when I am weak, then I am strong. And that Jesus said to him, my power is made perfect in weakness. And that runs all the way through this 2 Corinthian letter. It is the immediate context, because look at verse 12 and 13 of chapter 3. When I went to Troas to preach the gospel of Christ and found that the Lord had opened a door for me, I still had no peace of mind because I did not find my brother Titus there. So I said goodbye to them and went on to Macedonia. But, and then he introduces this, the theme of this whole section, 2 Corinthians 2:14 through 6:1. It's introduced with the word but. And the but is connected to this confession of an awareness of human weakness. He went to a place, the Lord opened the door, he was equipped to do it, but he just simply was something inside. He couldn't find rest, and it was a noble cause. He was worried about the church at Corinth. But the worry that he had about those Christians in Corinth kept him from doing what he went there to do, what he was equipped to do, what he was commissioned to do. He failed. But, he said, thanks be to God who always leads us in triumph and through us spreads the fragrance of the knowledge of Him everywhere, because we are the aroma of Christ. So we dealt with that, and Paul alludes to it. If you'll look in chapter 3 now, if you'll look in chapter 3, verse 4, such confidence as this is ours through Christ before God. Not that we are competent in ourselves to claim anything for ourselves. So you see, he's aware, and you'll have to be here later, and you'll have to have been here before. We've dealt with this and treated it pretty good, in a pretty good, to a good extent. So are all of you aware that you're a crackpot? All the crackpots, let me see your hands. Yeah, we're all cracked pots. Paul says we have this treasure in mud buckets. We have this. So if you're here today and you think that you're the only one that's not quite what you ought to be, welcome to the class. We're all that way. We're all weak. And it's in our weakness, a cracked pot, and you've got cracks and flaws and chips. He alludes to that. And that's what we've got here as the context of all of this, the whole subject. The context of it is your awareness that you're not there yet. Now, are you okay with that? Are you okay with being weak? Paul had a hard time accepting it. You know, he was given this thorn in his flesh, and he said he asked the Lord, how many times, take it away? Three times, he said, I asked him to take it away. And he said, hey, my grace it's sufficient for you. Well, Paul said, well, okay. Then I'll all the more glory in my weaknesses. But it took a long time for Paul to accept the fact that his weakness was God's power. And only when we recognize that are we going to be able to be of any value to God in doing His work. Now, you can have a program of your own, and you can make plans, and you can get this, and you can get all this outlined. But we're talking about doing God's work that He does through you, and He can only do it through a person that recognizes that he's weak. Does that surprise you then, that Jesus starts the Beatitudes, which is a verbal description of the character of a Christian? How does He begin it? Blessed are the poor in spirit. Paul must have learned this thing of weakness through Jesus himself as he gave this great Sermon on the Mount, which Paul probably didn't hear. But now he alludes to this, and we've got this as the context of divine power. It's human weakness. But more than that, in this third chapter, Paul talks about a classical, historical context. Now, I don't want to lose you here, and let me just say this. What we're going to be doing this Sunday and next Sunday are so absolutely crucial, not only to you and me as individual Christians, but what we're going to be doing today and next Sunday are absolutely essential to our movement. If we don't get this settled, and I told my son John last night, I said, I'm struggling with how to get this across so people can understand it. Because I said, I'm just going to sit on it until they understand it. and I'm here till the end of the year, and I'll just sit on it through the end of the year. If we don't understand what is said today and next Sunday, then I will have failed. I will have failed you. But you, in a sense, are a vanguard of what the church ought to be. Does that surprise you? And yet, you're on together in so many ways that, who would have recognized that? But you've got a vision that needs to be duplicated and spread. And you've got to understand, so what we're looking at is a historical context that pervades this whole third chapter. It's what theologians would call the Sitzen Leben, the situation in life in which the whole of Christianity came. You see, Christ came into a historical situation. He was born as a Jew. Now, that's no surprise to you. He was born as a Jew. He was born into, I don't know what the Jewish calendar year is, but we'll just call it first century Judaism. He was born into that period of time when the Jewish religion was at a certain point of its development or its deterioration. And what we're going to look at is the principal issue that was at stake by Jesus when Jesus Christ entered into a historical situation. What was the issue at stake? The issue at stake, the historical, classical, historical problem that Jesus faced was simply this: to get the old covenant people to become participants in the new covenant dynamic. If you want to look at a microcosm of the task that he had ahead of him, just look at the tussle that he had with his own disciples. He liked to never got them to understand a broader concept than the old covenant of kingdom, which had geographical boundaries, that had physical armies, that had physical temples. He liked to have never got them out of that. His number one problem was getting them to think on a different level, to use a different paradigm by which they would, a different lens by which they would view things. You know, they just never, they like to have never gotten it. The classical problem, let me just say it again, faced by the first century church was getting the old covenant people to turn loose of the old and adopt the new. You see, the Jewish nation, of course, first of all, were so racist that they thought everybody that was not a Jew was dying and going to hell, and they had to get them to be Jews before they could ever have any chance with God. There was a whole segment of the Jewish nation that held on to that till they went to their graves. Plus, there was a whole segment of the Jewish Christian sect that held on to that same concept until they went to their graves. And they carried the Jewish church with them. They just dug the heels in, and whenever the challenge to go into all the world and preach the gospel, they rationalized that, he means for us to go into all the world and make everybody Jews so they can become Christians. That's not what the mission was. That's what the majority of the first Christians thought, that that's exactly what God was intending, if he intended that. So the task was to get them to quit thinking in terms of the backwater of Judaism and the backwater of Jewish Christianity, and start thinking in terms of the whole ocean of Christianity, of the whole ocean of God's kingdom that was out there. And they wanted to stay in this little shallow water of Judaism. And they just simply said, we're not going there. You're not going to take us out there. They're not them stinking Gentiles coming in here unless you become Jews first. That was the problem. This whole text talks about it. Let's just mention, first of all, what was he talking about? What is the old covenant? We're talking about something here in Paul's third chapter. Look at it here again. Such confidence as this is ours through Christ before God. Not that we're competent in ourselves, But our competence comes from God. He has made us competent as ministers of a new covenant. Not of the letter, but of the Spirit. For the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. Okay, now what is this old covenant? If it's a new one, there's bound to be an old one. What is the old covenant? Have we ever had any trouble recognizing it and accepting that? What is it? The law of Moses. That was they knew what the law was. We know what the law is. As a people, we've been understanding that before other people understood it. In fact, we may have over-understood it because we've made such a distinction that sometimes we make no connection at all between the old and the new. But the old covenant, it's talked about all the way through Romans. In fact, guess how many writings in the New Testament definitely contained this as the issue? 24. Whew, well, no, it's less than that. It's less than 24. What is the first letter in the New Testament writing? I bet you won't get this one. What is the first letter that was written? Pardon? Galatians? That's close. You're close again, but you're not right. Probably. I'll give you a benefit of the doubt on this. It's the letter written by the elders that's recorded in Acts, the 15th chapter, to the Gentile churches to encourage them, don't let those Jewish brethren make you become Jews. You're free from there. But you've got then that letter, and then you have the whole book of Acts as a historical account and historical chronologue of this battle that went for decades, trying to get the Jewish Christian to stop thinking in terms of the old covenant dynamic and to start thinking in terms of this new universal God-fed, God-led movement that covers the whole earth. Well, you've got the letter in Acts, then you've got the book of Acts, and then look at all the other, I've written them down just so I wouldn't forget to mention all of them. Romans, 2 Corinthians, Galatians, Colossians, Ephesians, those five, pretty well just, that's the thrust of it. Then you've got 1 Corinthians, Philippians, 1 Thessalonians, 1 Timothy, Titus, that's five more. And then this past week in working on this, I decided, you know, you'd have to put Hebrews in there too. In fact, maybe that's one of the huge ones keeping them from going back into it. This transition, and then recognize it as a transition, this transition from the old covenant, the old dynamic, to the new dynamic, that transition was pre-spoken about, guess how many years? The Jewish nation was warned 700 years before the event took place. Turn to Jeremiah 31. 7 centuries. And we don't even think in those terms. We cannot think in terms of that long of a history. Beginning in verse 31, just 3 or 4 verses here, Jeremiah 31:31, if the Jews had had newspapers, here would have been the headline, Jehovah changes the ground rules, or new covenant to replace old. That's what you would have come up. Listen, let's read it. Beginning in verse 31. The time is coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their fathers when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt. What covenant was that? Well, the law of Moses. It's not going to be like that. Because they broke my covenant, though I was a husband to them, declares the Lord. This is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel after that time, declares the Lord. I will put my law in their, what? Their minds. I will write it on their hearts. I will be their God, and they'll be my people. No longer will a man teach his neighbor or a man his brother, saying, know the Lord, because they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, declares the Lord, for I will forgive their wickedness, and I'll remember their sins no more. Let's get a good visual picture of what that old covenant involved. The covenant with the Jewish people began individually when they would take an 8-day-old baby and circumcise it. And as an aside, do you know why they did it on the 8th day? The 8th day of the human's life, of a male human's life, its coagulation factor is higher on that day than on any other day of his life. Now, who in the world figured that one out? The one that made the humans. He was the only one that would have known that. But anyway, they did it on the 8th day, with or without the child's knowledge. All he was aware of was somebody was whittling on him. That's the only, if he had any knowledge, conscious knowledge of it, he won't remember it. But was it with his knowledge? No. Was it with his consent? No. So you've got it without his knowledge, you've got it without his consent. And yet he became a part of the Jewish covenant at that point. That was the Old Testament. That was the dynamic of it. So when the census taker came to the Jewish door and said, knock, 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 you know, and who, you were taking a census. What are you? I'm a Jew. Oh, really? Yes, circumcised when I was 8 days old. That's the old covenant dynamic. Now listen, it said, this new one is not going to be like that. It's not going to be like that old covenant. They're no longer going to be telling or teaching every man his neighbor and every man his brother, know the Lord. Why? He says, because they'll all know me. All who? Everybody who is in this covenant relationship will know God already. Because there is no covenant relationship with God without a knowledge of God. That's the difference between the old dynamic and the new dynamic. The new covenant dynamic is with the heart and only with the heart. The old covenant dynamic was without the heart. That's when it began. They had to teach them later on to be what they were committed to be by somebody else. They had to be taught after they had been committed by somebody else. In this new covenant, he said, that's not the way it's going to be. There won't be any covenant without the heart being committed. What does all that mean for us today? Does it make any difference? What difference is it? Well, it's almost obvious what difference it makes. What we're looking at today in 2 Corinthians 3 is the fulfillment of what Jeremiah was talking about in Jeremiah 31. Listen to the language. You've heard the language here. I'm going to make a new covenant. It's going to be written where? On the heart. It's going to be placed in your mind. Well, let's look over again at our text in 2 Corinthians. He says, look at verse 2. You yourselves are our letter, written on our hearts, known and read by everybody. You show that you are a letter from Christ, the result of our ministry, written not with ink, but with the Spirit of the living God, not on tablets of stone. What was written on tablets of stone? The Ten Commandments. But where is this new covenant going to be written? On hearts of flesh. The Apostle Paul in 2 Corinthians 3 is saying that what Jeremiah prophesied 700 years earlier, that God was going to do, he was going to make a new covenant. Paul is saying this is it. Now, is there any way to illustrate this? Yes, there is. How many of you have seen Fiddler on the Roof? Tevye and Golda, his wife. Tevye and Golda had been brought up in the old type covenant dynamic when it came to their marriage traditions and all. What was Tevye's major word they always used? Tradition. See, he'd been a part of a generation and where a matchmaker came in and made a match. Yeah, and so here she came. she'd come in and make a match between him and her. And see, you didn't have anything to do with it. You were out of the picture because she'd already made a match between this girl and this boy. Without her consent? Yeah. Their oldest daughter was the one that started this trend away. She fell in love. You've already committed yourselves? And he could not imagine anything other than this old system of a matchmaker coming in and without the consent of either the bride or the groom, and without the knowledge, really, of the mother and father until the matchmaker came in and made this agreement, and then that was it. And Tevye, toward the end, after all of his daughters fell in love, and they did not want to go out that old way. They didn't want a husband chosen by somebody else. They didn't want them being taken to somebody else's house without their knowledge, without their consent. And it began to get to Tevye. Tevye then one day, after it finally sneaked in and began to disturb him, he asked Golda, "Do you love me?" She said, "Do I love you? For 25 years I've cleaned your house, I've milked the cows, I've made your bed, I've slept with you in your bed, we've got four girls. Do I love you?" He said, "I know. But do you love me?" That's exactly the distinction here. What's wrong with this scene? What's wrong with this scene? I asked a man once, and we were going around the room telling about our conversions. This was this man's answer. He said, "Well, I married into the church." You married into the church? Does that make you God's son-in-law? Well, what he meant was that when he married his wife, he just became a member of the church too. Now look, a lot of us men have been brought to the Lord through a godly wife. And I'm not talking about that. Provided you didn't just be baptized in order to get her. And you can usually tell that kind, because once they get her, they usually off somewhere else doing something on whenever the saints meet, and they don't have really any interest in what she's about. They just wanted her, and so they go. Well, baptized, I can do that, yeah. Let me ask you a question then. What is your relationship with God today? Did you perhaps marry into the church? Or were you baptized perhaps so young that you didn't really know what you were doing? I was. Now, did it take? Have you grown beyond that to where you now, your relationship with God is one of spirit upon spirit and His heart upon your heart? Because I think all of us, when we were baptized, if you were baptized in your teens or perhaps even preteen, if you were baptized then, you really didn't. You think, "Man, I knew so little. I didn't know beans about what I was doing, really." Yeah, just enough to know that you felt that that's what you ought to do. And that's about all that a lot of us knew. And I'll guarantee you, if you reviewed your first attachment to the Lord from about 5 years removed or 10 years removed, if you reviewed yourself, you know what you'd be doing? You'd be doing the same thing a lot of people in the Boston movement are doing. They were being baptized 6 and 7 and 8 times because they would grow some, and they thought, "Well, I wasn't totally committed back there," so they baptized them again. It's as long as it depends upon works, your conscience will never be clear as long as your justification before God depends on works. Never will be. But if it's written upon your heart and it's based upon faith because of His grace, then as long as you're growing and maturing in the Lord, you're going to make it. It's just a process. If that's not good news, that's the new covenant. Do you understand how it applies to you personally? That's what we're talking about this morning. How the new covenant dynamic applies to us personally. What is your relationship with God? Is it just based upon some rules and some rituals and some rites? Biblical though they may be, if that's what your stand before God depends upon, you're still operating under the dynamic of the old covenant.